Good morning. You're watching Deprogram with Ted Rall and Jamarl Thomas. It is Tuesday, May 19th, 2026. Thank you so much for joining us. Lots to talk about, as always. Good morning, JT. How was your last 2 hours on the air?
It was good. I actually used Rumble Studio for today.
Oh, wow. How did it go?
I actually used Rumble Studio. So last night, I did two streams. I did the stream showing that Donald Trump chickened out of an attack. No, I didn't want him to attack. So yes, I'm glad he chickened out. But let's be clear, he chickened out. And so when I did that video actually went relatively, it took me a bit to figure it out, like what was going on. And I even put it on the wrong channel at one point. Like it went under my username as opposed to my regular name. But it went okay. It was close to StreamYard. There are annoyances. Like it doesn't work in Indonesia. There's that.
What? Rumble Studio doesn't work in Indonesia?
No, the link didn't work in Indonesia. My guests had to use a VPN to get around whatever controls. Because, you know, Indonesia might have rules against it.
It's funny, because having been to Indonesia, I mean, it's definitely, like, authoritarian, but it doesn't feel brutal.
It doesn't feel that way when you're there.
No.
I mean, but I guess you can say any country, right?
Like, yeah, I mean, of course, I didn't do anything wrong, right?
Right. Right. You're not rubbing up against the law in Indonesia.
Right. In no way, shape, or form, yeah.
I enjoyed Indonesia. I was there last year, back in September, I think. September, October, I stayed there for 2 months. Personally, I liked being able to get on a bike and drive from point A to point B and pay 25 cents for the transportation costs.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot to be said. I was a moped freak. Loved riding around on my moped all over the place.
Yeah. But it was good. It didn't go bad. I prefer StreamYard because StreamYard is more simplistic. Rumble can be a little clunky.
You'll get used to it though. There's a lot of things. I mean, yeah, there's little things like, for example, I like putting up the banner that's at the bottom of the screen, right? Like on StreamYard, you can have it on a timer, which I really love. Then you don't have to babysit it. Here you have to take it out. But on the other hand, you can sort of get like, it's a little more elegant to have a smaller banner at the bottom than you do on StreamYard, where it's really big and fat.
I can't use my layout. That's the issue. Mm-hmm. Like, I have a layout for StreamYard. I don't have a layout for this. Like, they have a different size in regards to their presentation screens.
So but you can definitely create, in the design, we're doing the whole, we're geeking out here, but there's a way to do it here. I can show you how to do it.
Yeah, I mean, because I added the background to it, but the sizes are different. StreamYard is different. They allow
you have Photoshop.
I would have to go to Photoshop and edit.
Listen, I have Photoshop. If you need me to do it for you, I'll do it for you. It'll take me like 5 minutes. No big deal.
Okay. So far, it was very close.
And the resolution's a lot better. Mm-hmm. You can definitely tell. All right. So obviously the main story today is this fatal attack leaving 5 people dead, including 2 attackers at this Islamic mosque in, there's no other kind of mosque, at the mosque in San Diego. We'll talk about that. Iran and the U.S. continue to negotiate to no end. The Donald tacoed out, as you alluded to earlier. He claimed that he had a big attack, the biggest attack. Nobody's seen such a big attack, the best attack that was going to happen today. But then he said that at the request of various Arab Gulf state allies, he decided not to proceed. Who knows if there's any validity or truth to that whatsoever. It doesn't seem like the two sides are close at all. Another resignation based on principle from the Trump administration. We had not really seen any of those for decades. I'm glad to see that some government officials are growing a spine. The top lawyer at the Treasury Department, Brian Morrissey, quit in protest of the $1.8 billion taxpayer-funded slush fund that you and I have talked about here, JT. Finally, I know you're going to want to talk about Putin's visit to China. He'll be hanging with Xi Jinping, who just got done hanging out with Trump. So Xi's been like doing some major hosting duties lately. And we'll talk about that. I think we should get San Diego out of the way, if that's okay.
Yes.
Okay, so So these are, this is, as they say in the business, this is a developing story still. The motives, however, seem to be clear. The two alleged attackers here were found dead of self-inflicted gunshot wounds, 17 and 18 years old. They had gone missing and kind of like, you know, presumably in a sort of Columbine mode. At least one of them was wearing camos and fatigues, and there, and his mom reported him to the police because she was worried sick. They were looking for him at the time. They had issued some kind of declaration about white pride. So it seems that right-wing politics were somehow involved here. It seems pretty clear what happened, right? Like two right-wing teenagers worked themselves up into a fucking frenzy in it, and decided to commit an Islamophobic hate crime and went to a mosque, killed three people. Then we don't know if this part was pre-planned or not, or whether they were overcome by fear or the horror of what they did. We probably never know that. But then they killed themselves. You know, I mean, there's going to be the usual blame game. Usually this goes the other way around. But I could definitely see people on our side of the politics saying, well, this is because of the atmosphere of hatred that's generically been, you know, ginned up against Muslims in this country, not just by this current president, but also by previous ones. You know, that may or may not be true. It may be a contributing factor anyway. That part, I'll give you that part. You know, I mean, it's I don't know. What do you think the political ramifications of, if any, of this will be?
I mean, let's put in context where we've attacked a Muslim country. Let's start there, right? Donald Trump, in a war of aggression, attacked a Muslim country. And I'm not going to make this one-to-one relation between hatred that might be stirred up in regards to attacking Iran or what it means to attack Iran. And then all of a sudden you have people who are under you attacking Muslims. But there is a culture. So I remember, do you remember when Obama was running and he kept using the term, he's a Kenyan Muslim, he's a Kenyan Muslim. And the wild part is, if you would look at the polling on it, Muslim of all the religions was the one that America's liked the least, which is part of the reason why Republicans use that as a refrain to effectively hit him. You know, we can call him a Muslim as opposed to calling him other things that are not necessarily palatable in American culture, at the very least.
Yeah, it's very otherizing in our culture.
It is. And so by the same token, we haven't seen a huge number of these. Like, meaning a group who ended up in a suicide pact, whether they planned it or not, because ultimately they end up, whipping, as you pointed out, working themselves into a fervor and murdering other human beings. It is very hard for me to get in their headspace. It is very wild to me that two people can do this, let alone one, because on some level they have to have some kind of agreement that they're going to go and do this. I don't know.
I think it's actually more likely for me, at least the way I'm wired. You know, I'm riddled with self-doubt, and but if I have confirmation from someone who I like or respect or love that I'm on the right track, I'm much more confident about my course of action. And you know, I mean, did you ever see the movie Heavenly Creatures?
Yes.
So it's based on a true story, right? I think in New Zealand, where basically two friends decided to murder one of the two girls' sets of parents. And basically there's like a homoerotic component to it. We don't really know if they were lovers or not. But basically they kind of worked themselves up. There's a lot of magical realism in the movie, but it's meant to get into their brains about, like, you know, they're living in a fantasy world, right? They're teenagers. You know, your brain isn't really done until you're 25, right? Ish. And so, like, your judgment isn't fully formed. You can't see the big picture. And, I mean, I could easily see being 17 or 18. And, I mean, I did a lot of stupid shit. I didn't kill anybody. But, I mean, the point is, you know, your judgment just isn't what it is going to be later on. So, you know, I think if you really decided like, oh, Muslims are the enemy or whatever. You choose a group and you're like, these people are, you know, bad for the country. You know, we're doing what needs to be done. We're taking out the trash. I can see getting into that headspace. I'm not recommending it, but I mean, to me, it's not wild and foreign.
I get being angry. That I get. I mean, like when I was younger, I was heavy into this like, Black liberation stuff. Like when I was in high school, and it was like white people are evil. I can't believe this took place. And part of it was just because in reading history, like it's like, oh my God,
there's a lot of supporting evidence.
Yeah. Well, right. Like, as I got older, it became this thing of like, okay, well, dude, people are people. Mm-hmm. Like, this is not a group issue. This is basically you deal with people as individuals, not necessarily as this kind of mythical group. Past is not prologue. Like, meaning you grow, you evolve, you realize that your views of the world are not necessarily correct, and you change those views. But murder seems different to me. Like, this is kind of like,
Not to mention, these are random people. I mean, who've done you no harm, who've meant you no harm. You don't even know them. You know, they're minding their business. You don't know anything about them.
Well, it's just based on the group identity. Like, right. And then because, you know, people would say, I have Black friends. And people are like, oh, that sounds so bad. But what they're effectively pointing out is, look, as an individual and dealing with people, I see Tyrone as somehow different than the larger group of Blacks that I may not necessarily like. And I would wager that they would say something similar if they had a, quote, Muslim friend. And they would say, well, Muhammad is okay, but those other ones got to go. Like, they would say stuff like that, making the distinction between the individual that you get to know versus the group that you have these ideas about. And the body ideas are something enough.
In this case, we don't know if these kids had any positive views or had any Muslim friends at all. Well,
true. I'll just use that as an
example. But yeah. I mean, we just don't know. So obviously, we'll continue to follow that. But, you know, we have a lot of other stuff. Anything, we should probably do a few comments about, get just through some comments and then we'll go. Okay. Black Spock 135. Thanks very much for the $5. All my hopes from Lieutenant Uhura. Said to Admiral Kirk in the movie Search for Spock.
That's what it was. Okay.
I always forget about the movies.
Yeah. The movies were, some of them were great.
Some of them, yeah.
Yeah, some of them were great. I mean, don't get me wrong. They're
duds. Let's go into the whale one.
Yeah, the whale one was a dud. But Spock dying is traumatic. Even
so
to
good. Point.
It's so good. You will always. You
one thing I appreciate about the movies, and I think that I much prefer the shows, but one thing I appreciate about the movies is the fact that they understood that movies are a different format. Like, you know, like there's the X-Files movies, which are basically just long episodes. And you're right. The Star Trek movies recognized from the very beginning that cinema is a completely different format. So it's almost a different world. Not just the uniforms are different, but like even the politics are a little different. It's sort of like how Peanuts, the TV specials, are not Peanuts, the comic strip at all. They're different.
Well, it's the same universe, the same people, they act the same, but yes, the format is different. Like it's slightly different in regards to the way they do the format.
Robbie, hello. Can you tell Jamarl we love him and this is his show as well? He keeps referring to it as Ted Rawls deprogrammed. I come here for both Jamarl and Ted. This is your show too now, Jamarl. That's true.
Okay, fair enough. It just takes a while. When I took over Fault Lines for like a year, I felt like this is Garland's show. I should be here.
That's funny. Man,
the insecurity. I felt horrible for taking the job. It took a while. But yeah, I tried to say I will be on with Ted on the program or something like that. I need to come up with a different way of saying it.
Well, the name of the show is, you know, it has your name in it. Philip Blair, thank you so much. Three of you. Yes, indeed. You three make a good team. There aren't enough places where we get to hear friendly differences of perspective.
Oh, that's sweet.
No, that's really true. just filming really, yeah, this taco thing is crazy. Like, what do you want him to say? I always chicken out, so I'm going to do it this time. Kind of silly mocking him for backtracking. Fair.
Oh, that's for me. I'm not yes, I am mocking him for backtracking. But I'm mocking him backtracking, not because I wanted him to have the strikes or attack Iran. I'm mocking him because it's his own frame of reference.
He shouldn't make the threat in the first place.
He shouldn't make the threat. He's out there screaming that he's going to destroy Iran. That he's going to literally kill everybody in one of those other tweets that he put out. Okay, and now you're saying, I was going to attack him. I was going to do it. We had it all lined up. But I postponed it because people asked me not to do it. It's like, dude, you are in a position where there are no good options. Nobody told you to invade Iran. Nobody told you to attack Iran. Nobody told you to put yourself in the country and the globe in this particular position. So yeah, I mock him because he shouldn't have made the threat in the first place. Like, these aren't negotiations. This is some kind of mob nonsense of, you know, hey, either you make a deal with me or I'm going to murder you.
Well, this is his shtick. Obviously, look, you know, I don't know if you and I have talked about this, but I had very very brief dealings with him in the late 80s as a banker.
Trump.
With Trump, yeah.
Did you?
I did, yeah. So
you never told me this.
Okay, well, yeah. So basically, well, look, it's like if you were in New York in the 80s, you met Donald Trump probably. So I worked at the Industrial Bank of Japan Trust Company in New York. Mm-hmm. And my boss came to me and said, we have this Taj Mahal casino project in Atlantic City. Donald Trump is applying for a $25 million revolving line of credit from us and from 9 other banks for a total of $250 million. That's kind of a standard thing back then to do, like it still is, where you pull money from different banks. So he's like, my job was as a junior officer, crunch the numbers and see if it's viable. So Trump organization sent over the documents. By the way, I'm one of the few people who have gotten to see Donald Trump's personal tax returns.
Did you?
And I did. I remember I came home and went out with my girlfriend that night and I said, good news, we're richer than Donald Trump. Because, you know.
Are you serious?
Because your assets minus your liabilities are your and the thing is about rich people is rich people are not usually rich. Rich people are people who have a lot of credit. So they can borrow a lot of money. Rich people don't usually have the money in their account. Donald Trump does now, but back then he didn't. People were just, he was a grifter. And he's not really unusual in that respect. Anyway, so I crunched the numbers. I came back to my boss and I said, we did do due diligence. We drove down to Atlantic City and it was it's still very sketchy, but it was a war zone in the 80s. I remember my Japanese boss, Shibuya, and I sitting in the car and we're looking at the blueprints and we're like, okay, so it's going to be across the street. No parking deck? Like, no parking deck. And so my boss goes, do you think white people are going to drive here from the suburbs and park across the street where we are right now, dodging bullets on their way to and from the hotel? I'm like, no, I don't think they will. And so anyway, we went back to New York. I crunched the numbers more and I was like, it's not even close. This is like ridiculous. Like, default is guaranteed. There's no way this project could make money. It can't. So say no. So we called and said no. Someone from the Trump organization said, Donald would like to hear it from your lips directly, man to man.
What? So Donald needs to hear it from
now
you.
Now, bear in mind, the Trump Tower is on Fifth Avenue in the 50s. Our office was at Park in the 40s. It was a short walk. So, like, half a mile, maybe. So, anyway, we're like, okay, we get to meet Donald Trump. We're not afraid of Donald Trump. We don't give two shits about Donald Trump. So Donald, this is like 1988-ish. Yeah. And this is around the period when, you know, he's on the cover of People magazine as like world's most eligible bachelor and all that, like with the fluffy hair. And he has that like sort of boyish look. Anyway, he walks in and I remember my boss goes, look, it's like Mother Goose and his little ducklings, because like he had his little lawyers like walking behind him, like one by one, and Trump walks in, and he's like, "Well, so why, you know, why are you returning us down?" And my boss goes, "Well, Mr. Ted crunched the numbers, and he said they're bullshit." And then Trump goes, "And who the fuck is Mr. Ted?" And then my boss, without missing a beat, and I loved him for this, said, "Mr. Ted is who the fuck says you don't get your fucking $25 million.
Is that what he told Trump?
Exactly what he said. And then he's like, "Fine." He got up. Mother Goose leaves with all the little ducklings falling. Goslings falling. Pardon?
And he said that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Japanese, they tend to be a little bit more chill, like a little bit more self-effacing.
Yeah, but my boss was from Hokkaido, which is a disadvantaged, a traditionally disadvantaged ethnic group from northern Japan. So he looked different. He was he acted different. He was brilliant, by the way. I mean, he was one of 20 officers. He brought in 24% of the revenue for the bank. He was like completely a genius. Like I remember he was the kind of guy, like when the Tax Reform Act came out, he came by my desk, drops this fucker on my desk and goes, "Read that. We're going to look for loopholes in new financial instruments." I mean, that's the kind of guy he was. But yeah, so, I mean, the point is that getting back to Trump, he just liked to threaten people. And like, but as you say, it's stupid. I know he always does it, but it's not a smart way to negotiate.
Well, not only is it not a smart way to negotiate, it's the fastest way to lose credibility. And as I keep pointing out, just because Trump says that doesn't mean he doesn't attack. I'm of the mind that he will attack. I am of the mind that Iran is not going to get... They murdered Soleimani. They murdered the Ayatollah. They've attacked Iran in the middle of negotiations. I don't get the sense that Iran is going to give them a win.
Yes. No. I mean, the Iranians they're not fucking stupid. I mean, like,
exactly.
They know what he's on about. I mean, RJ Ramrod, shout out to GIMP as the absolute best free open source Photoshop alternative on the internet. Yes, it is. It didn't work. It doesn't work for me. I don't know if they fixed this, but when I was looking to get rid of Photoshop because it went to from a one-time purchase to an annual subscription model, which I fucking hate as a cartoonist, I have to have Photoshop. Cartoons have to be saved in TIFF format, CMYK TIFF, and GIMP didn't allow that. They only allowed you to save in RGB. This is very geeky. But newspapers are printed in 4-color process and RGB is for the internet. And so I kind of was hoping someone would do a plugin or fix that in some way. Thanks so much for the $9 donation, Magical Unicorn Cat. As a high school teacher, I know with every fiber in my being, there were teachers who flagged these students as needing support and investigation. I can guarantee those teachers were ignored by the administration.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, imagine that as a teacher, you're like, okay, something is wrong with Bob.
They know.
Bob's drawing, you know, is putting in artwork where he's murdering people. Hey, we need to see something about this. And then happens?
Although I got called out for that shit, like in elementary school, because I only used the black crayon. And it was like, oh, obviously that's very dark. I'm like, I'm a future cartoonist. All cartoons were black and white back then.
I mean, do you think that they were flagged and that the teacher effectively, like the principal, just basically ignored? I mean, because that's a hell of a thing to say, right?
I think there's a strong chance.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously the parents were aware, right? The parents were like, they're gone. They called the cops. They were worried. I would say that doesn't seem like it doesn't seem like this would have come out of nowhere, right? This
Absolutely.
Is kind of behavior. One day you're awesome kid who spends all his time at the library studying ups and puts on camos and like grabs a bunch of guns and gets going. I don't think so.
Yeah, agree.
Let's see. Robbie from Diane Thomas. I do enjoy when you give Jamarl and Ted history lessons on the Bible.
Thanks.
And with that, and let's see, last one for now. GV man, I've never met an intelligent racist, and yes, they are weak. Usually they have grievances towards some race because they don't want to be responsible for their own failures. Yeah. I would agree with that. Yeah. I mean, it's these things are like, yeah, well, whenever you externalize your problems, even if you're, I mean, you can do it like I could do it, you know, with some validity, like, well, you know, the billionaire class, the wealthy, they're fucking us. That's true. But, you know, buck up, buttercup. This is the society we live in, and you have to do the best you can with the cards you've been dealt. I mean, I was, for me, a huge takeaway was I visited San Quentin with the lifers, and I was talking to them about, like, sort of, well, how do you deal with it psychologically, knowing you're going to be here for the rest of your life? And they said, like, oh, the first year, you basically are like banging your head against the side of your wall of your cell. You're crying every night. You're just miserable. But at a certain point, and this several guys said this to me, you realize this is where I live. This is my deal. This is my life now. And you try to make the best of it. And you read, you study, you work out, you try to get straight with yourself and accept your reality and do the best you can given your circumstances. And I think when you're externalizing your problems and complaining about the man, even though the man might be responsible, you know, it doesn't really help.
Kind of, yes. I guess from my point of view, I look at it as there needs to be a realistic, legitimate appraisal of reality. And if, in the context of that appraisal, assuming that you're correct in your appraisal, that there is some environmental circumstance that is creating difficulties for you, I have zero issue with the idea of trying to change those environmental circumstances.
Oh, yeah.
The problem, right, that's just life, right? I mean, like, going into politics is acknowledging an issue and trying to change that issue. Schoolboy philosophy of politics, anyway.
Voting, protesting.
Yeah. Right.
Agitating.
Not murder. Murder is different, right? Like, meaning, if your appraisal of reality, you come back, Muslims are the problem. Your appraisal is wrong. Your appraisal is very wrong. Or correct. The Chinese are the problem, or the Russians are the problem, or the whatever is the problem. Your appraisal on that, in that context, is wrong. Now, if you come back and say the billionaire class is screwing over the American public by buying politicians and effectively putting laws there, okay, that's correct. But yeah. Is the response to that, okay, now I need to murder billionaires in order to
get... On the other hand, I mean, this does come... All right, we have to mention Luigi, right? I mean, he was just in court yesterday for a hearing. I mean... Look, I understand also the desperation of looking like, you know, what appears to have happened with Luigi is like, we have this huge problem with healthcare in this country. Nobody seems able or willing to do anything to fix it. Everything's corrupt. At some point, maybe an assassin's bullet is the solution.
Right.
I mean, it's not irrational. It's like all the people who tried to kill Adolf Hitler.
Your point is political violence is sometimes necessary, despite what all of the media and everything. I mean, look, media and politicians have a bias towards not having political violence for obvious reasons, that they're in politics and they don't want the public to rise up and get aggressive in regards to trying to change the political system that we have at our disposal. It is an irrational act to pretend that political violence is not a thing.
Right.
They do it all the time. They do it all the time. Now, the catch becomes, is that going to accomplish the objectives to which you are trying to set for yourself? If the objective is just to pop off on somebody, okay, fair enough. If your objective is to change the political system, that's going to be different.
Yeah, yeah. And I think Luigi is a great example, right? Like, let's just say for the sake of argument, I mean, look, this would be like, it's a comic book. Like, it's the Watchmen kind of solution, right? Where let's just say, you know, a healthcare CEO couldn't walk out the front door without getting popped. I don't know what that world looks like because that world doesn't exist. But let's just say that were true. Would it force them to shape up? I'm skeptical. I think they would probably just look for better security.
Yes. I think they would look for better security. They would pay more money to have a crackdown by the state. It would be stuff like that. I mean, look at the day how they reacted with Luigi. They flipped out. It's like, oh my God, this is completely unacceptable. How dare you shoot a billionaire?
They're bitching about, like, you know, Governor Newsom's tax on the billionaires, and now you know, Mayor Mamdani in New York and his pied-à-terre tax. They're acting like it's the fucking Holocaust. They're taxing billionaires. They're all going to leave the city. And I'm like, by the way, I got to ask you this. It occurred to me this morning. I was thinking about that because they were talking about it on local radio here about Mamdani and the whinging on the part of the billionaires about, like, they're going to tax the billionaires. I'm like, first of all, I'm not really sure how it hurts an ordinary New Yorker to have someone who, you know, not be able to buy or want to buy a $200 million apartment. I'm not sure, like, how that changes anything. All that's going to happen is maybe developers will, instead of making one $200 million apartment, will make 20 $10 million apartments instead. But the conceit is that billionaires live where their businesses are. Lots of people, you know, own a business in Alaska and live in California, right?
China.
I mean, we're not all like, it's not like we live in 1860.
Right.
You know, every house has the, you know, on the second floor of the store is the apartment where the shopkeeper and his wife live. I mean, look, you know, sure, Elon Musk moved to Texas. Elon Musk has facilities all over the world, right? I mean, whatever. I don't know. It makes no sense at all. So, like, you can leave California. It's like, as long as there's money to be made in New York or California or any other high tax place, there will be business there.
Yes, there will
be. Whether the billionaire who owns the business is there or is not, is neither here nor there. Who cares?
And Bezos can get by with $50 billion as opposed to $100 billion.
Right.
Michael Killen. Yeah.
That's the thing too, right? Like, the effect of a billionaire in terms of gentrifying the economy and making housing unaffordable. I mean, it still blows me up. This blows me away, right? So, Jamal, in New York City, the median apartment is $5,000 a month.
That blows my mind.
To qualify, it's like $5,100. To qualify for that apartment, like, if you get a realtor, he's like, show the apartment. You're like, I like it, I'll take it. You have to show proof that you make 40 times more in your annual income than the monthly rent. So if the rent is $5,000, you have to show that you make at least $200,000 through your tax returns. Okay. You have to show that. So riddle me this. The median New Yorker makes nowhere close to $200,000 a year, right? The median New Yorker makes probably $80,000 a year. I mean, it seems to me like you're not going to, even under capitalist constructs, you're not going to have a system that works unless the median rent is somewhere around the median income, you know, for qualifying.
Ideally, yeah. I mean, like, I never understood how people could afford to live in D.C., to be frank. I mean, and the median rent was nowhere near $5,000. I think I was paying $1,900 a month, and I lived in a not necessarily the greatest of neighborhoods in D.C. And I was actually making decent money at the radio station.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how people afford it. Like, people who work at coffee shops or people who work at, let's say, fast food or convenience stores or whatever. I don't know how they afford to live in those areas. And Lord knows, I don't know if anybody affords to live for $5,000 short of somebody just.
I mean, some people have like weird things where it's like, oh, like, you know, I got a $1 million settlement because I was hit by a car when I was 16. Come on, that's like one person in a million. And it's like,
so, or random,
like, people with rich parents. It's like, people always, Americans love the exceptions, right? It's like, remember when Colin Powell, you know, rose to prominence? It's like, look, you know, it's like, it's easy to, you know, if you're black and you work hard, you can become a 4-star general and become a future president, maybe. It's like, the reason he's in the news is because he's an exception. Okay. Yes. That's why we're talking about it. I mean, it's like, no, I mean, it's like, oh, systemic racism isn't a thing. It's stupid. Anyway, sorry. I mean, I'm in a ranting mood.
It's all good.
Yeah. All right. So President Xi, he's hosting Putin. He just saw Trump. Do you think there's going to be any messaging like where that basically Xi tells Putin, "Hey, so Trump told me last week about like Ukraine," and do you think there's going to be any passing of messages there?
So I assume there's strategic alignment among China and Russia.
Oh, for
That's
sure.
my assumption, just because of how close the two countries have effectively become over the course of the time that the United States has been putting pressure on both. Because you would know this. In the old days, the thought was, okay, we're going to work with China against the Soviet Union. I'm going to work with the Soviet Union against China. The idea of trying to deal with both simultaneously was just weird. And then to get to the point of saying, okay, after we've maligned you for all of these years and gone after you for all of these years, we're now going to work with, Russia to go after China. It's like, dude, it's too late. You've literally overthrew a country to go after Russia directly, and has demonized them for all of these years. And you did something similar to China, especially with Trump at the helm. Or even going back to Obama with the whole Trans-Pacific Partnership stuff of trying to sew up world trade in order to exclude China from the thing. Meaning, we have gone after both. And we have, in doing so, pushed these countries together where they have singular, or let's say common interests in this case. So, yeah, that's going to be a strategic, let's say, conversation in regards to these two. Apparently, they're going to be signing multiple deals or multiple pieces of legislation together. Getting across that much more how close they are together. And they're putting out a statement talking about a multipolar world, effectively saying this is now a multipolar world. Obviously, this is aimed at the US's naked aggression against Venezuela, Cuba, Iran, and whoever else gets in the way at this point, but perhaps Colombia, perhaps another country. So the words are nice, I suppose. But yeah, I suspect they are working in tandem. And let's be honest, from a cynical point of view, the US attack on Iran benefits China and Russia in the way that this is damaging to the US, especially from the global economic standpoint. Russia has all the gas in the world, China has all the gas reserves in the world. They will be okay for the time being. We are the ones that are being hurt by it. Hence, I would imagine that is also probably going to be part of the conversation.
Ironically, July 4th, 2026, our 250th anniversary is also looking a little bit like the beginning of the crunch, right? For in terms of energy prices here in the United States. I mean, the stock market's going to be wide awake by then. And the energy market, the oil markets, the oil futures markets will be wide awake by then. And I mean, it's going to be a very uncomfortable birthday party at the UFC cage match on the White House lawn.
The wild part about it is, and I guess there are two parts, the energy markets haven't really priced. It's almost like they haven't fully accommodated what's happening right now. Almost like it's too big. Like it's almost like a Cuban Missile Crisis in regards to something is taking place out there on the oceans, on the seas, that is somehow, in this case for us, affecting us. In the case of the amount that you're paying for gas, the amount you're paying for groceries, the amount of inflation, et cetera, et cetera. So it's very strange. It's this thing that's out there that's happening on the high seas that is very dramatic. These attacks are taking place, et cetera, et cetera. And we are feeling the negative consequences from it, which is necessary. Like, I don't mean to sound like an asshole for this, and this is not necessarily something I all that much enjoy. But the idea that we can go and attack other countries without a consequence seems outrageous to me. There should be a consequence. There should be some feedback mechanism that tells your leadership, don't do that. It's like raising a child. And in raising a child, you let the child do whatever the child wanted to do. And then you're shocked when the child becomes a grown-up and it's a maniac as a grown-up. It's the same thing. We have been able to go into country after country after country without there being not significant consequences in a way to hit the American public, where the American public burned the White House to the ground as a result of their pain. this may be different. And as you point out, July is going to be the driving season. Assuming this still goes, that's why I believe there are going to be more strikes. Because I don't believe for a moment that that Trump, A, can maintain a blockade for this long. It's already porous. B, deal with the economic fallout of Iran's blockade, their blockade, especially if there's this kind of continuous standoff and the oil supplies and everything else dwindle in the way that they're dwindling. I've listened to financial people talk about this, and you've, as you point out, have done financialization yourself. They are somewhat perturbed or shocked that this hasn't been priced in yet. That people still are listening to Trump, thinking to themselves, yeah, he chickens out. And so he'll back away. And the catch is, it's a war. It's not a tariff. Like, this stuff is going to start getting priced in July, August, et cetera. It's going to be bad.
I mean, you brought up this point before, and I often think about it, like a lack of consequences for the United States, right? Look, you can argue that, look, whatever, if you disapprove of what Russia did in Ukraine, Russia faced consequences. There have been, China probably feels that it would suffer consequences if it invaded Taiwan. But the United States, Nazi Germany faced consequences. Imperial Japan faced consequences, ultimately. Not for a long time, but ultimately. And there's no end in sight for US military hegemony. And obviously, there's no end in sight for now. But I think even in 1933, if you were forward-looking, you could see that, Nazi Germany could awaken the sleeping giant that was the United States, and it could come down on them. In fact, that was anticipated by German high-ranking German officials who visited, who had been to the U.S., and they told Hitler, who had never been, he had never, Hitler hadn't traveled much, and they told him, like, you don't understand, like, you can't fuck with the Americans, like, right now they're busy with the Depression and all that, but if they set their minds to something, their industrial capacity is just unbelievable. You won't be able to defeat them. And, Hitler didn't really understand or take that seriously. But yeah, but for the US, there, I mean, I've always thought when the EU started that the EU could be the only military and economic counterbalance to the United States. It was viewed as an economic counterbalance, as a trade bloc that was meant to offset. That didn't really kind of work out, but certainly not as a, it was never viewed as a military counterbalance, which is really too bad.
Europe has started two world wars. Yeah, true. I mean, counterbalance is not necessarily a bad thing. I just don't trust Europe in this case.
Well, you can't.
But that's the rub, though. Like, if there were consequences, let's say the Iraq War, because we lost less than 5,000 people, even though we killed like a million or got a million people killed in that conflict, meaning as a result of us going in. That doesn't even include the 500,000 that Bill Clinton apparently killed through sanctions that Madeleine Albright said was necessary, meaning killing kids. There was no pushback. Like, can you imagine if Putin was sitting there or Lavrov was sitting there and they said, hey, Lavrov, we've noticed that you've killed 500,000 kids in this war. Can you imagine like the outrage that would be there? And instead, you get muted disagreement from the world community, but they don't say anything. Even Russia, Lavrov, when Lavrov was like, yeah, Iran has a right to enrich uranium under the non-proliferation treaty. Okay, I need you to be stronger. I need you to state it with your chest. Because all things being equal, you are under attack. Iran is under attack. We've just avoided going after China because hashtag reasons. But I hope you get my point. None of these things had major consequences. And you might have gotten this kind of strongly worded letter from somebody, but consequences, no. In which case, we didn't care. Because we don't care about your letters. Well, now it's different. Now it's different. We will see consequences.
Yeah, that's true. Some more comments. Manchild says, I think Russia is running scared of Ukraine and Putin is looking for a handout.
I don't think that's the case at all. Rightly scared how? They're taking, hundreds of kilometers of territory. And just because they may have slowed down because of issues like drones and weather and those type of things, Ukraine has a manpower shortage that is astonishing. Russia's built up additional military capacity that they haven't even used. And a military that was 150,000 as well to 700 and what, 50, 700, 800,000. If Ukraine, who had a 3-to-1 advantage when this war started, and Russia still was able to take 20% territory, how on earth does anybody expect them at this point to do anything? They are a drowning man.
Yeah, I'm really tired of reading these stories about like, yeah, Russia's about to crack. Russia's about to crack.
It's been 4 years. It's gone on 5 years. And the momentum has gone in one specific direction. Let's be very clear. Like, meaning, yes, drones have been a pain in the ass, just like they are for Israel in the Hezbollah thing. But from the standpoint of drone technology, Russia dominates. From the standpoint of the battlefield, Russia dominates. I don't get the crack stuff.
By the way, do you believe that? Do you think that there's anything really worth talking about Taco Tuesday 17.0 that just happened today? Do you think
Yes, I do.
what's notable?
Because when Donald Trump, and do you remember when this first happened, like when the war started? And within March, Trump was like, well, the Pakistanis came out and said, hey, let's have peace talks. And then what we realized was it was Trump that pushed Pakistan for peace talks because Trump didn't want to look weak by asking for peace talks. And now you have the situation where Trump is like, yeah, I was going to attack them with this most powerful attack in the history of attacks. But because the Saudis and the Emiratis and the et ceteras asked me, I decided against it and to let negotiations take
Because I'm
place.
so magnanimous.
Yeah, nonsense. He understood, as somebody in his orbit understands the negative consequences of that attack, or let's say the response to that attack. Meaning, if indeed you're talking about hitting infrastructure and water, like desalination and everything else, then all bets are off. And from the standpoint of the infrastructure of Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, UAE, et cetera, it's toast. It's toast. So it's not an issue of, hey, we can't get oil through the straits. It's we can't produce it, which is a whole different order of magnitude of damage and chaos. My point of view is he, or at the very least, somebody has explained that to him. So yes, he may still attack for issues of hubris and ego and narcissism and everything else. But I suspect that part of the thing that is creating this kind of contradiction in his policies is this is going to be dramatically bad. And it's going to be in my lap when it happens.
Yeah, he's going through right now the feelings that I did the first time I had to jump off the high dive at the municipal pool in Kettering, Ohio. It's like, I can't go back down because all the other kids will make fun of me, but I
Yes.
really don't want to belly flop from 12 feet up. It's going to really
Yes.
hurt. Oh, and I don't know what to do. That's where
This is
he's
gonna
at.
hurt. This is
Robbie,
gonna
what
hurt.
you were saying in the chat that you've been wargaming this out.
Well, I don't think it's about Iran at all. So, like, for example, if you look at Reuters, I always like to look for
Twitter.
concern indicators, whatever. They're what they are. What I like to do is I like to look at American media specifically, and then just kind of war game out exactly in the opposite ways that they're saying. So they have an exclusive saying the Russians are covertly being trained by China to return and fight in Ukraine. First, that doesn't make any sense. The China, the Russians have the most battlefield experience than any other army on the planet. If anything, it's the other way around. Here's what's going on, I think. China leads the planet in manufacturing and drone and battery production. So if in the Russia and China are have a strategic alliance, Russia's not at war with Ukraine, they're fighting Ukraine, but they're at war with NATO and the United States in a proxy war.
Right.
That's true.
So if you want to defeat Russia, you have to take China out of the equation. How do you do that? You do it by strangling their oil supply. How you do that? You do it by attacking their Iran, which is the biggest oil partner, the biggest trading partner that China has in regards to oil. Plus, the Japanese are starting to get kind of uppity. They're starting to get this idea that maybe they're a real country. Maybe they don't need to be occupied anymore. Maybe they can actually be independent after 1945. Well, Japan has the same problem that they had in 1935. They don't have any oil. They get all their oil from the Persian Gulf. Right. This is all about controlling the entire Middle East, controlling those oil fields, and strangling China and keeping Japan in its box. That's what this is all about. This has nothing to do with Iran. This is about trying to strangle China to break, to make it aware that the Chinese are not able to support Russia with the drone and the drone technology that they have, especially the hardware, like the batteries and such, to try to inflict a defeat on Russia, because even the Danish prime minister said Europe cannot allow Russia to win.
Yeah. Well, he did say that. True.
Yeah. I think that's what this is. This Iran is a pawn. It's not the game.
It's a little bit of both. I mean, okay. Everybody that I've talked to that has pointed out, even Lavrov, I think, made the point of saying the U.S. is trying to control global energy markets. It's this way of trying to maintain this kind of hegemonic control of things. The problem is that China has land routes. And that if you've noticed, the amount of traffic between Iran and China especially has started to go over land. Because, meaning a lot of this stuff can be supplied over land. And China has the largest energy reserves on the planet by far. Like, it's not even close, the amount that they've been using in regards to oil and gas and the amount that they've saved up. The U.S. has been pumping out from our strategic reserve millions of barrels every day to try to effectively cut down on the cost that we're seeing at the pump. Meaning the point that I'm making is
they're even trying to get rid of the federal gas tax.
Yeah.
It's only 18 cents a gallon. I mean, yeah. Gas has gone up $2 a gallon.
Exactly. So the point that I'm making is, if that's the plan, that plan is dumb. From the standpoint,
from the standpoint of
Iran, keep in mind, they've had a hard on to take down Iran for decades, going all the way back to like the George Bush administration, where the thought was we need to get rid of Syria in order to open the door for Iran. Even George Bush Jr., right, when John makes this point of how when he's talking about the Iraq war, Dick Cheney comes in and is like, and we're going to be in Iran in X number of weeks. They've wanted Iran for a very long time. So,
1970. Agreed.
So, agreed, Robbie. This could be about going after China in some particular way. But let's be honest, there are also people in this administration that have a hard on for taking down Iran in this kind of Israeli first.
I want to sort of echo Robbie's point that just because someone has a stupid goal doesn't mean it's not their goal, right?
True. True.
But China, I think we can all sane, rational people would say is ungettable. They're uncrushable. They're too big. They're too big to be failed. Okay. But at this point, is there anyone in the administration who doesn't believe that? Is there anyone who thinks, oh no, we can corner China? I mean, that's hard to believe.
Well, just to be clear, Robbie, I'm not saying that the idea is dumb in the case of you mentioning. I'm saying it's just a dumb idea that the administration may have. I'm agreeing with you that there may be, meaning there are some people who are in, let's say, the strategy part of this. I don't believe Trump is in the strategy part of this, if I'm being blunt.
No.
I think the U.S. policy is U.S. policy, regardless of the president. They can change it, but all intents and purposes, Trump is effectively gone with it. I do think that if given
what would happen? You know, I always wonder about that, right? Like, this is sort of the Hollywood president, right? Like Bullworth.
Yep.
What happens if if a president is elected, he or she is an outsider, they come in and they're like, all right, new sheriff in town. I've decided we're going to normalize relations with Iran. We're going to exchange ambassadors. We're going to get rid of sanctions. We're going to be buds. What happens? I mean, obviously the phone calls start coming in and all the guys with the big stars on their lapels and all the lettuce on their chests come in and puff up and tell you that you don't want to be weak. But what happens really? I mean, can you hold your ground? Is that change in policy even something that can happen under our ossified late capitalist system?
I think so. I mean, I'm not so cynical to believe that the president doesn't necessarily have power. I mean, even from the standpoint of a bully pulpit thing, he will be tested. Oh, he will be thoroughly tested, though. I mean, this is kind of like Kennedy, right? Dealing with the Soviet Union, where it's like, hey, these guys lost X amount during the war. We need to understand our enemies and so forth. Meaning you could make that argument to the American public. You would have a large segment of the American public that would back you on it. And you would have to live on the public to do whatever you're going to do. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of the audience is going to disagree with me on this and think it's impossible that a president can't do it. I don't buy it. I think he could. Give me your take on this. Do you think I'm full of shit on this? Robbie, you too. I'm curious.
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually more interested in what Robbie has to say on this because, I mean, I don't know the answer to that question. It just seems like it's literally the biggest question of them all. Is the system completely – is it basically like the policy is the policy and you just have, you know, change in personnel and, you know, the lead actor is just changed every 4 years or so? But basically it's the same role all the time? Or is it possible to actually have a radical change in policy? I mean, there haven't been a lot of radical changes in foreign policy.
No. The last one was what, Kennedy getting shot, I suppose.
Right.
Trying to bring things home with the Soviet Union.
The presidency is a figurehead. It doesn't matter. I mean, the United States by design lobotomizes itself every 4 to 8 years. With the turnover of a new presidency, but the bureaucracy never changes. And then you have civil service laws that make it where even if you get a president who wants to be an actual reformer, you can't fire the people who are there. So if you can't fire someone, does that person work for you? The answer is no, by definition. So the beat goes on, they do as they're told. And then at the end of the day, then you have all of the campaign finance, you have all the money that's coming in from all of the interests and all of the lobbies. We don't have a country. We have a board. We have a corporation that's ran by a board of directors. We have a CEO who goes and talks to the press, but he doesn't actually do anything. The entire idea that we even have a representative system of government
actually is a fascist state would be more flexible, right? Because a fascist state is a dictatorship, and the dictator can change the policy overnight, right? Look at Nazi Germany. Like we hate the Bolsheviks. Oh, look, we have a non-aggression pact with them over Poland. Oh, wait, we're at war with them.
Xi Jinping doesn't wake up every morning looking at a map. And he looks over at Taiwan and says, okay, how am I going to take this island back? No, he wakes up every morning and his biggest concern is how do I feed over a billion people so my head doesn't end up on a spike?
Right.
That is his biggest problem. And I think that's why, that's one of the reasons I came up with this conclusion about Iran. It's to cause domestic economic problems to try to contain China because China's geography really hems it in more than anything else. If we control their sea routes, we could strangle them. That's what this is about. And the trucks, while yes, they are a thing, don't carry anywhere near as much oil as a ship does.
True.
Two comments.
Well, those are choke points. I agree.
Before we go out, get out, because we're out of time. Not the Cat Williams. I thought the UFC cage match in the White House lawn was a joke. Alas, it is not. No, it is not. Phrasmataz, Ted, check out Mark Felton, a Royal Society historian. He just did a video on the former SS Charlemagne French SS, who were tasked to redeem themselves by fighting in Vietnam. I will check that out. The Charlemagne Division comes up in The Sorrow and the Pity, the legendary documentary about Vichy France. Anyway, it's 10 o'clock. We are out of time.
Thanks. Hold on. Peter gave us a $2 rant. He says, boys go to Baghdad, real men go to Tehran.
yeah, better not to be a real man, really. Anyway, thanks all for joining us. Appreciate you. Please stay tuned for TMI Show with me and Manila Chan, except it'll be Robbie West again, filling in for Manila. We'll have a lighter take on the news. You guys, see you later in the afternoon. We're talking about shit, and we'll see you at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, where we are at 9 a.m. Eastern Time, Monday through Friday. Ciao.
Have a good one, guys.